back to Shattering Myths. It's always my pleasure to speak with IQ Al-Rasuli. IQ is the most articulate, the most courageous, the best informed, the most effective spokesperson in the world regarding the true nature of the Islamic religion and the consequence of the world embracing it. And while I'm always pleased to talk to my friend, some mornings even a bigger priority than others. This morning, IQ, I was on a talk radio show. Was booked by probably the same fellow that booked you on the same show. It was a nationally syndicated show with many hundreds upon hundreds of stations. And the topic was Iran and Islam. And the host was just bewildered, overpowered. Deer caught in the headlights when I explained that there was no way to prevail in Iran and that the problem with Iran is Islam and that Islam is the sponsor of 99.9% of terrorist acts because it is Islam itself, its prophet, its God, its Quran, its Hadith that orders Muslims to behave as terrorists. You are the antidote for such problems, for people, lack of understanding. And IQ, I ended the interview by explaining that the only possible hope for this country to avoid the effects, the ongoing effects of Islamic terrorism, is for talk show hosts such as this woman to read Prophet of Doom, Lifting the Veil is also a very good resource. To come to know the true nature of the Quran and Hadith and therefore of Islam and then to courageously and compassionately speak out against the religion. That words wielded wisely are vastly more effective than bullets and bombs. What do you think?
Absolutely agreed. I've always said, do not bury the Quran, do not tear the Quran, do not hide the Quran, read it. And any human being with decency and two brain cells of logic, by the time he finishes chapters 7, 8, and 9, that's it. He doesn't need to read more.
Yeah, or even 5. 5 has the most dastardly passage in it of all of them. In fact, 5 really conveys so many important aspects in terms of our understanding. 2 is also, by the way, very effective, as is 3 and 4. In fact, any of the Medina surahs. Stunningly effective in communicating the true nature of Islam. The Quran in the Ninth Surah, you mentioned the Ninth Surah, says specifically that you can't be a peaceful Muslim. It's emphatic. In fact, it says it over and over again, that it's impossible to be a peaceful Muslim. The moment a Muslim advocates peace, they become a good person, they cease to be a Muslim from Allah's and the Quran's perspective. Isn't that true?
That is absolutely true, yes. That's why I always say to Americans listening, there cannot ever be a silent majority which is moderate. That doesn't exist. There are no shades in Islam.
Right.
Islam has two characteristics. You are either black or white, sunshine or darkness. You are either a Muslim or you're not a Muslim. And if you're a Muslim, you're going to be a jihadi Muslim. That's it.
Correct.
End of conversation.
Yeah. And that's not your opinion. That's what the Quran states.
It's what, that's
what Muhammad said. And in fact, the Ninth Surah was specifically written to convey that reality, that according to Allah, according to Muhammad, according to the Quran, that if a Muslim is peaceful, if they're a good person, they cease to be a Muslim. I don't know the term in Arabic. It's translated in English as they become a hypocrite. And then Allah tells the good Muslim jihadists that it is their...
In Arabic, it's called munafiqun.
Hypocrite. And what Allah says repeatedly in the Ninth Surah, which is the second to last revealed, is that good Muslim jihadists must kill the former Muslim, the pretend Muslim, so that he himself can attend to that person's torture in hell.
Correct.
So if you are a peaceful Muslim, your God hates you. It's a lose-lose situation. If you are a peaceful Muslim, your God despises you and is going to torture you in hell.
But you can't be a peaceful Muslim. The minute somebody is a peaceful Muslim, he's not a Muslim anymore.
That's right. That's what the Quran said. That's what the Quran says.
Exactly.
You know, we are dealing with the catalyst for World War III taking place right now in Syria. But Syria is simply a proxy for the problem. I'd like to go back a little bit and talk about how this problem began, because this is the match that is going to light World War III, and billions of people are going to die as a result of this. So it's important that we share how this all began. There is infighting today between Sunni and Shia Muslims. Between Sunni and Shia Muslims, they represent 99.5% of Muslims are either Sunni or Shiite. And as I understand it, about 85% of Muslims are Sunni, with about 15% being Shiite. And correct me if my numbers are wrong. But I'd like you to speak about how the two branches of Islam began, and where they're the same and how they're different.
In fact, Islam split the day Muhammad died. Approximately 632 AD, they say Muhammad died that year. The moment he died, his son-in-law and his cousin, Ali ibn Abi Talib, attended to the burial. The companions of Muhammad, who were not part of the bloodline, they met amongst themselves and decided to elect a Khalifa. Khalifa is the successor to Muhammad.
Mm-hmm.
So at that very instant of time, the beginning of the schism between Shia and Sunni started. So what is Sunni and what is Shia? Sunnis are the ones who follow the Sunnah of Muhammad. And they believe that according to their understanding of what Muhammad bequeathed to them, any Muslim with good character, with good intelligence and knowledgeable of the Quran, can be elected to be the leader of Islam.
Okay, so let's spend a little more time here on the Sunni and what Sunnah means and how it is based. What you said is brilliant and is great. I just want to help our listeners even have a deeper understanding. The non-related parties, because they thought that anybody could, they really weren't talking about anybody. It was kind of smoke and mirrors. It was the ruling tribe in Mecca that provided the original funds and arms for Muhammad. They wanted supremacy over everyone else. So it was the specific tribe and clan in Mecca that thought that they were entitled. Now, as it relates to Sunnah, which is Muhammad's example, where will you find Sunnah? Is there more than one source of Sunnah, or is all of the Sunnah come from a singular source? And if so, what is that source?
The Quran and the Hadith.
Well,
the Sunnah is the Hadith.
Yes, the Sunnah is the Hadith. The Quran is, now, realistically, Muslims have a conniption fit when you say this, but it's true. The Quran is Hadith, the Hadith, what it means is all reports from Muhammad and his companions. Now, the Quran does not overtly discuss Muhammad's life and behavior. It serves as justification for everything that Muhammad covets. But the Hadith is based entirely on Muhammad's words and example. So if you want to know the Sunnah, which is the example of Muhammad, you're going to find that in the Hadith, which are all reports from Muhammad and his companions. Now, is that accurately stated?
100%.
Okay. So in the Hadith, so we understand what Sunnah is. In the Hadith, as it describes the behavior and character of Muhammad, how do the Hadith, these are all reports, depict Muhammad as a wonderful, inspired, merciful leader who is teaching the world valuable insights as to how to all get along, uplifting all peoples, all genders, all races? How is he depicted?
The Hadith are remarkable in that they depict Muhammad in the most atrocious, disgusting way imaginable. I mean, the Hadith depicts a man called Muhammad as a pathological liar, a mass murderer,
yes,
a child rapist, a predator upon women, a plunderer. I mean,
a kidnapper, a kidnapper, a slave trader,
a kidnapper, a slave owner. I mean, you name it, he had it.
Yeah, and by the way, those are the hadith. The ones that we have today are the ones that were judged by the first Muslims to be in absolute compliance with the Quran and that had the most reputable chain of transmitters providing them. No hadith is available to us today that isn't consistent with the Quran. So the same pedophile, rapist, womanizing, thieving, terrorist, mass murderer, kidnapper, slave trader that's depicted in the hadith is all confirmed in the Quran. Otherwise, we wouldn't have those hadith.
Absolutely right. This is the most remarkable thing. There was a book by Robert Spencer.
Mm-hmm.
He said, did Muhammad exist? I mean, the question is stupid. I mean, I love Robert Spencer. But the question is stupid.
That's one of us.
Of course he existed. There is no way in hell that any of his companions would have depicted a creature with such vile characteristics had he not been right. It's impossible.
That's correct.
They would have glorified him.
They would have glorified him. They would not have made him a pedophile. They would not have made him a terrorist. They would have not made him a multiple rapist. They would not have made him a thief, a kidnapper, a slave trader, a pathological liar. And that's how he's depicted in the hadith, and that's confirmed in the Quran, including pathological liar. Read the opening of the ninth surah. Because of that, there is no chance in a gazillion opportunities that the Muhammad of the Hadith was made up. You don't depict the founder of a religion in such a repulsive way. It's true. He absolutely was as they depict him.
But there's a fantastic thing. This is exactly the remarkable thing about the Hadith. And that's why they are to be true. They have to be believed.
Now, let me ask you one more question.
Go on.
Oh, I just gotta say, let me ask you one more question about the Sunnah, because it's the basis of Sunni Muslims, which they claim to be aware of and to understand and act upon the Sunnah, the example of Muhammad. All of the Sunnah, which is the Hadith, were they not written under Shiite control?
Yes. That's another remarkable item.
Every single aspect of the Hadith or Sunnah of Muhammad was comprised under the brief dominion of the Shiites.
Of the Abbasid Empire. Under the Abbasid Empire.
Welcome back to Shattering This. I'm your host, Yada. We're having the opportunity to speak with the most informed and courageous spokesperson in the world related to Islam, IQ Al-Rasuli. He is the author of Lifting the Veil, The True Faces of Muhammad and Islam, which you can buy from Amazon. There were two statements before we move on, IQ, in the last segment that just befuddle Muslims to the ends. One is that the reality is that the Quran and Hadith are the same, that the Quran actually is Hadith. It's an oral report from Muhammad. And second, that the Sunnah, the Hadith that comprises the Sunnah, that define Sunni Muslims, were all compiled without exception under the control of the Shiites during Islam's early formation. I get a chuckle out of both of those two things and how unpopular those truths are.
Well, the Hadith were compiled under the Abbasid Empire. And the Abbasid Empire was not the... was definitely Shiite-oriented.
Yes.
Al-Bukhari, a Muslim, all of these were under Iranian tutelage.
Right.
So... It's an amazing thing. Not only does the Hadith depict Muhammad despicably, but it was written by the Shiites. Amazing.
Yes, and so the Sunnis are actually devoted to books that were compiled by Shiites. And the Shiite domination of Islam in the early years, they were where was their capital?
Bukhara, if I remember correctly. I might be wrong.
But they were headquartered out of what we would consider to be Iran and Iraq today.
Oh, yeah.
Tigris and, yes. Tigris and Euphrates River, Mesopotamia. That is where they established their caliphate. When the Sunnis came to power, they moved. They didn't hang there in Mesopotamia, in Iraq and Iran. Where did they take their capital and place their capital?
Well, the Sunnis placed sometimes in what we call Al-Qahira, Cairo, that we have today in Egypt.
Yeah, before that, for about the first 400 years of the Sunni domain, they were headquarters in Damascus, today Syria.
That's the beginning of Islam. Absolutely.
Yeah,
right. But that's
absolutely.
The beginning of Islam.
Yeah, that's the beginning of Islam as a world power. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's kind of interesting, of course, that that now a Shia government controls Damascus, and that the Sunnis are in a desperate bid to eradicate all of the Shia so they can reestablish total Sunni domination over over Islam, and they're doing so in Damascus, which is was the capital, the center of the Sunni influence. So you now explained, we now know who the Sunnis are. Who were the Shiites? What differentiates them?
Okay. The Shiites were also Muslim Arabs, but they honestly believed that the only legitimate follower to Muhammad must be of the bloodline of Muhammad. And the only bloodline that was available at the time was Ali bin Abi Talib, because Ali bin Abi Talib married the daughter of Muhammad called Fatima. Mm-hmm. He was a cousin also of Muhammad, so he is part and parcel of the bloodline. So the Shiites totally believed that only through the bloodline of Muhammad, that is Ali bin Abi Talib and his children Hassan and Hussein, were to be followed, and whoever after them forever descendants.
And so they took a Shura day, and they took a Shura day which Muhammad observed, which was an observance of a pagan moon god in Assyria, and they applied a Shura day to the death of Muhammad's offspring, correct?
Yes. Yes.
Now, is there any way to beyond the fact that that the Creator God of the universe isn't going to establish ruthless thugs as his messengers, or pass on the right to rule the world since he's into free will through blood? But is there any way for there to be a Shiite, therefore leader? Under this premise, can anybody actually prove that they're related by blood to Muhammad today?
Well, first of all, the Shia is only 15% of Islam.
Right.
So, to start with, the probability of them ruling Islam is zero.
Correct.
Even if they found somebody with a bloodline directly as a descendant of Muhammad, it's null and void. Because the majority, the Sunnis, don't believe that you have to be of the bloodline. So already
Correct.
They are losing.
Correct. So, first of all, they couldn't make such a claim. And second of all, even if they did make such a claim, they're a 15% minority.
Correct.
So, now that we know who the Shiites are and who the Sunnis are and what percentage of Islam that they represent and what little divides them, which is strictly who's in charge of Islam, and which right now no one is in charge of Islam, so there should be no division at all, we will play this forward into the world as we are witnessing it today in Iran, Iraq, and Syria. Welcome back to Shattering Myths. I'm your host, Yada. We're here with IQ Al Rasuli. I'd like to double back just a little bit before we move to the present time, because I want our listeners to understand the words that you have used. You've told our listeners that Sunni Muslim is based upon the Arabic term Sunnah, and you've explained that the Sunnah is the example. In fact, I'm reading here from Wikipedia, if I may. Sunnah is the way of life prescribed as normal for Muslims on the basis of the teachings and practices of the Islamic prophet Muhammad and interpretations of the Quran. The Sunnah, which is plural, Sunan, Arabic, is derived from the root sa'na, meaning smooth and easy flow or direct path. The word literally means clear and well-trodden path. So, to be a Sunni Muslim, by definition, you are following the path and example set by Muhammad. Is there anything that I have missed here? Is that a accurate depiction of the Arabic terms?
Well, you couldn't possibly have missed anything. This is why they are behaving the depraved way that Muhammad used to behave.
So it was essential that you took the time to explain the words and deeds of Muhammad, because to be a Sunni Muslim, by definition, you are following the example of a rapist, a pedophile, a ruthless terrorist, a mass murderer, and a habitual liar.
Absolutely. That's exactly who they are. But that's what we see 24 hours a day on television. What do we see? Mayhem,
wow.
Plunder, rape,
wow.
Enslavement, kidnapping, butchery. I mean, well, what else do we see?
So let me make certain that our listeners understand this. Is there anything that differentiates Shia and Sunni Islam, Shiite and Sunni Islam, other than the devotion of Shia Muslims to Muhammad's son-in-law and cousin, Ali?
None whatsoever. There is no difference. Absolutely.
So exactly the same hadith sources, exactly the same Quran.
Even though the Shia do not approve of the sources of the Sunni hadith, and the Sunnis do not approve of the Shia hadith, irrespective that they do not approve of each other's hadith, they follow the Quran, and they still follow the Sunnah.
But the fact is that...
Sorry.
Just get right back to the hadith. I studied this for years and years and years. I was unable to find any hadith source other than four that were compiled within 250 years of Muhammad's life. And if you go by hearsay of mouth to ear for more than 250 years, your likelihood of having anything right, falls off the face of the planet. I only found that there were four. The first to compile hadith did so in a biographical form. That was Ibn Ishaq, and his biography is called the Sirah, the biography of Muhammad. The next to do so was Tabari. Tabari wrote the first commentary on the Quran and was the first to compile a history of Islam. And his Tariq, or History of Islam, is the second comprehensive and only the second chronological depiction and presentation of hadith regarding the words and deeds of Muhammad. And then there were two topical collections that were compiled approximately at the same time, and that one was compiled by Bukhari, the other one was compiled by Muslim. But those four sources of hadith was all I could find that were actually compiled and put into writing within 250 years of Muhammad's death.
Yes, that's a fact. Not negotiable fact. Nonetheless.
And so those, but don't both Sunni and Shia Muslims therefore have to consider those hadith? I know that Shia Muslims also buy into this 12th Imam thing, but that was conceived much, much, much later, many, many hundreds of years later.
Correct. That's true. Yes.
So if you're going to, the word Shia is based on the Arabic meaning followers, faction or party, but it's a follower. So you're a follower of Muhammad in this particular case. The only way you can follow Muhammad is to read the Sirah, the Tariq, or the Bukhari or Muslim chronicled hadiths. I mean, that's the only way to do it.
But that's the only thing they have. They have nothing else. There's nothing else.
Okay, so the argument between the...
They're not Muslim.
Yeah, so the argument between the two is only based upon, I will expand it instead of saying one thing, it's based on two things. The first is leadership, both past and present. And the second is that Shia Muslims have added and fairly recently, chronologically, way after Muhammad's death, centuries upon centuries after Muhammad's death, they added this whole mythos of the 12th Imam, And so they consider those to be prophetic writings depicting future events. So that would be the only two differences between them.
Otherwise, there is no difference.
Okay.
They follow the same thunder. They follow the same hate. They are the same hate-mongering, misogyny, mm-hmm. racism, mm-hmm. intolerance. It's exactly the same.
Okay. So for them to have exactly the same religion other than these two minor aspects, why would they rape each other's women, torture each other's children, kill each other by the many hundreds of thousands, just as they're doing so right now in Syria?
Because each side considers the other one infidel. Very simple. What do you do to infidels? You massacre them, you rape them, you enslave them, you torture them, you plunder them.
Right. In fact, they consider one another to be apostates. And what does the Quran? What does the Quran say that good Muslims should do to apostate Muslims?
Cut their heads off.
There we go. So that's why they're doing so in Syria. Now, this is such an odd situation that we're witnessing in Damascus and in Syria, because Shias, as you said, have no chance ever to control all of Islam. They only represent 15% of Muslims, where the Sunnis represent 85%. So what happened in the world to cause the Iranians, the Shia, predominantly Shia Muslims, to be able to rise up and be empowered so that we would be experiencing such a horrendous proxy war between Sunnis and Shias in Syria? What happened?
Well, it's the stupidity and cowardice of our leaders. That's what happened. There is no other explanation. How did Iran become Shia all of a sudden? Because they removed the Shah of Iran. Carter allowed the removal of the Shah of Iran and replaced him with a theocracy called the Ayatollahs. Right. Otherwise, there was no problem in Iran. There was no problem. Iran was secular.
Right.
Saddam Hussein was secular.
Yeah, it's the reason why there is still an enlightened...
Saddam was secular.
Right. That's what there was and a very small remnant of them now, but there was an intelligentsia in among the Persians in Iran because of the opportunities that were afforded to Iranians under the Shah. And the same thing is true in Iraq. There was an intelligentsia. There was a group of people who were fully capable of building things and of being responsible and of being well-educated in Iraq, too, both under those two secular dictators. But that doesn't exist anymore.
No. Because the West interfered.
So what you're saying is the United States invasion of Iraq, which is the only way that the scenario that you've just described, it's a direct result of the United States invasion of Iraq, where the United States foolishly deposed a secular dictator and allowed an Iranian-controlled government to replace him.
Correct.
And
no question.
You said something a week ago that I was unaware of. I knew that the government in Iraq was wholly devoted to and took all of their marching orders from the Grand Ayatollah al-Sistani. And I knew that he was an Iranian mullah. But you pointed out that his very name affirms that he came from Iran.
Sistani is in Iran. It's not in Iraq. Google Sistan and you'll find it.
Wow.
Many of these people are Iranian in origin. They're not Iraqi. They're not Arab.
So we removed a secular, which means the Persian. Persian, Iranian, right. So we removed a secular dictator over Iraq, who is the enemy of Iran, and we allowed the Iranians to take total and complete control of Iraq. We gave their enemy to them as a gift on a silver platter through our invasion.
You're doing the same thing in Afghanistan, by the way, but not to the Iranians. You're giving it to the Taliban.
Which is Pakistan.
Which is Pakistan.
Right. The Pakistanis, right, the Pakistanis created the Taliban for the express purpose of controlling Afghanistan so that they could put a pipeline down western Afghanistan and have access to the Caspian Sea oil and gas reserves. That's the reason that the Pakistanis actually created the Taliban. That's why the United States used the Taliban. We armed and equipped the Taliban to fight the Soviet-backed government, that the Taliban was absolutely conceived to fight so that the Pakistani government could gain control of Afghanistan. And by our invasion of Afghanistan, we have, in effect, given Afghanistan to the Pakistanis.
Correct. To the Taliban. And the Taliban is in control. Pakistan is in control.
And a matter of fact, it's kind of like Vietnam in a way. When the North Vietnamese were fighting the South Vietnamese before America interfered, it was just a long and ghoulish battle, and both sides had successes and failures. Once America intervened and started using bullets and bombs, we manufactured so many enemy that that the moment we engaged, we made the situation worse. And when we finally left in defeat, instantly the Vietnamese, the communists, took over the whole country. We facilitated the worst possible outcome by the sacrifice of our blood and coin. We did exactly the same thing in Iraq and Afghanistan, didn't we?
Yes, and now you're doing it in Africa. You're doing it everywhere in the Muslim world. You're wasting time, you're wasting life, and you're wasting money everywhere.
And in every single case, as is our involvement in Syria, we're making a very bad situation infinitely worse. So there is something worse than doing nothing. Doing the wrong thing is much worse than doing nothing.
Absolutely.
We'll return to Shattering Mist with IQ Al-Rasuli after the commercial break. Back to Shattering Mist. This is our last segment this morning and for a week with IQ Al-Rasuli. IQ, what you have basically said is that the choices that governments made, particularly the American government, in trying to deal with Islam, made a bad situation infinitely worse, and that we created the mess that the world is seeing today. That is the result of our choices, of our activity. But is there also not a consequence of our inactivity? What's going to happen if we just ignore Islam?
You can't ignore Islam. They will not let you go alone. They will destroy you. You cannot, no European country, no American country, no China, no Russia can ever ignore Islam. You ignore Islam, you destroy your future generations and your civilization. It's very simple.
So you're saying they won't allow the West to ignore them because they will continue to terrorize the West, and if you ignore them, they will prevail through terrorism.
Absolutely. They're doing it in Africa. Okay. Look what they're doing.
Okay, so now right. So we got two points here. Your point one is the things that America did by invading Afghanistan and Iraq, and by arming the rebels in Libya, and by arming the fundamentalist Muslims in Syria, are all making a bad situation much worse. And you've said that if we do nothing and ignore Islam, Muslim terrorists will destroy us. So we know the choices we've made have been wrong, the actions we've taken have been wrong, and doing nothing won't work. What will work?
Revealing what Islam is all about on television, on radio, in the news media. Destroy Islam's cult belief system.
Like so what I did this, so what we're doing right now, what I encouraged this the woman to do, who was the host of a nationally syndicated talk show, which was to read Lifting the Veil, to read Prophet of Doom, to study the material, to come to know Islam as well as we do, and then have the courage and compassion to speak out against it, to expose and condemn it. If we get more people to do that, that is our only hope relative to the onslaught of this horrible menace.
By the way, it's the cheapest way of doing it. Cheapest
Correct.
In life, cheapest in money. It will cost nothing whatsoever, not a penny.
Right.
And we will save millions and millions of people, both Muslims
Correct.
Who will apostatize and people
Correct.
Who did not know about Islam.
Right. But the NSA claims, the American NSA claims that they're spying on everybody to protect Americans from terrorism. All they would have to do is go online and read Prophet of Doom, which is available free. Lifting the Veil, and they will know infinitely more about this enemy and how to stop this enemy than they could ever know through all of their billions of dollars of spying apparatus. It's all there free, isn't
it? Not billions. They spent over $1 trillion in the last 10 years.
Yes.
And they got nowhere. They got nowhere. They don't understand Islam. Even today, they don't understand Islam like you understand Islam, like I understand Islam.
So even if they were to go buy our books and not read them free online or not listen to us, our willingness to teach them freely, they could spend $50 and about 100 hours of their time, and everybody in the world, including those at the NSA and CIA and FBI, they could all know exactly who this enemy is and how to prevail against them, which is to wield their own words against them. Isn't that what you do? Isn't that what lifting the veil is all about, is wielding the words of Muhammad against him?
Correct. And this is what your book, Prophet of Doom, is about. Exactly the same way. Different points of view, different directions, but exactly the same result. The complete annihilation of Muhammad as a prophet and the alleged divine origin of his Quran. Complete.
Yeah. Yeah, the only difference actually between Lifting the Veil and Prophet of Doom is how we arrange the material. We cite exactly the same material, which is the Quran and Hadith, and that's both books are based entirely on the Quran and Hadith. The only difference is you arrange your presentation by topic, and I arrange the presentation chronologically.
Correct. Correct. But the end result is exactly the same. There is no human being on planet Earth and no intelligent life outside the solar system who can debate you or debate me and win. It is impossible.
Yes. What I've always said about Prophet of Doom, and I've had millions of letters of people writing in opposition to it, I've never had a single Muslim raise a single valid complaint against it. And I'm totally open. I said, man, if you can criticize it and write a rebuttal against it, if you can in any way disprove any aspect of Prophet of Doom, I'll take it down. I'll remove it from the internet. But no one can, because it's based entirely on Muhammad's words and deeds, on the five oldest Islamic sources, as is Lifting the Veil. The only way for a Muslim to discredit either book is for them to discredit the words and deeds of their lone religious founder, Muhammad, to discredit the words of their God, Allah. And that's why none do it. But that's the gift that IQ Al-Rasuli is giving to you. Read Lifting the Veil. Read Prophet of Doom. Come to understand the nature of this religion and join us. Have the courage to expose and condemn it. The world needs you.